Thanks for downloading Think from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from History International, circling the globe with the series The Naked Archaeologist to solve 2,000-year-old mysteries. Wednesdays at 8 Eastern on History International.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is journalism a less ethical profession today than it has been in the past? Americans have been bombarded in recent years with stories of plagiarism, fraud, and deliberately biased reporting, not in the blogosphere but at old guard media institutions. So how are we to decide where to place our trust? And is there a risk that consumers of news and information will decide there's no value in professional journalism anymore? Neil Henry is a former Washington Post correspondent, and as a current associate professor in the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, these are issues he worries about a lot. He writes about his concerns in a new book called American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in the Age of New Media. Neil, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
You believe the craft of fair and independent reporting is in critical danger today. What tells you that journalism has gotten into such dire straits?
It's largely economic. There are fewer and fewer revenues to support traditional journalism, and I mean in particular television, for instance, but most importantly the print media, newspapers and magazines. And for many years, many decades, these publications have been the vanguard, the chief protectors of ethical values in the industry. The economic challenge is presented by new media outlets that we all know about, the web, the internet, where so much information is free and available instantly online. And as, of course, you know, in Dallas and many other cities around the country, what this means is less profitability for newspapers. And when there is less profitability, someone pays the price, and it is trained professionals who increasingly around the country are losing their jobs. And because journalists are losing jobs at these outlets, the values are also under siege. And when I mean values, I mean they're sort of enshrined in the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics, which is dedication to independent reporting, minimizing harm, serving the public interest, and being dedicated to seeking and reporting the truth. Those are essentially the broad outlines of the issues I try to address in this book. And every day, you know, the situation gets worse. In Dallas, the morning news, as you know, over the last couple of years has lost 30% of its newsroom. And the newspaper, which was once a real leader in journalism in the country, winner of numerous Pulitzer Prizes, has certainly gone down in quality. And it's certainly the case here in San Francisco, where just a couple of months ago, the paper announced that a quarter of the newsroom would be let go. And my concern is that no matter what we feel about the role of newspapers in American society, and certainly a lot of people, a majority of Americans certainly have beefs, the fact is that nothing is replacing these trained journalists. There's nobody out. There aren't people going out in the blogosphere to cover school board meetings or to cover court cases, to research public records, to do the sort of hard work that newspapers have traditionally provided.
Are you bothered by people who make these comparisons between bloggers and professional journalists? In other words, is it sort of apples to oranges?
There is a kind of belief that citizen journalists can fill the roles that traditional professional journalists have filled. And it's certainly an idealistic belief that it would be great if we could all believe in. I'm not convinced that citizen bloggers, which is largely, blogosphere is basically made up of a great deal of cant and commentary and rants about the news, but very little proportion of the blogosphere is actual original reporting. And so it is, in a way, comparing apples and oranges, and I don't have the faith yet that the blogosphere is a promising place to replace the news we have traditionally gotten.
Now, certainly most journalists come through journalism school, but there are plenty who come from other lines of work and become professional journalists. I'm wondering, though, Neil, if you can describe for us what the process is like for a young reporter or producer who is sort of cutting his or her teeth in the industry and how that would be different from someone who's just sort of decided to take on a blog project.
It's not true that most journalists working in the industry today come from journalism schools. I think a number of them do, but I mentioned in the book, in fact, that the people who I've admired most in my career, and I spent 17 years at the Washington Post as a local, national, and foreign correspondent. I was based in Africa for 3 years back in the early 90s. But the people who I've admired most in journalism had nothing to do with journalism schools. I mean, they got degrees in everything from medicine. I worked with a doctor who sat next to me in the newsroom for a number of years and who decided to become a journalist. And they're basically liberal arts degrees in a host of different areas and decided to go into journalism for just the sort of intellectual challenge of reporting the news and contributing some good original content to the American public. I'll talk a little bit about my background and compare it to what's going on now. I went to school. I graduated from college back in 1977. And I, like many people of my generation, were greatly influenced by the hallmark reporting of the press back in the 1970s, which included some seminal works during the Vietnam War by Seymour Hersh and also the Watergate reporting by the Washington Post and to some degree by the New York Times. Anybody my age, I'm 53, will tell you that these were the seminal moments that sort of prompted us to go into journalism and see it as a viable career. And I went to grad school at Columbia and then started my career at the Washington Post, where I was very proud to be part of a community, a group, a cadre of other like-minded people dedicated to trying to do what we can to inform the public. Now, there are people going to our program whose futures are not as clear. When I had a job when I came out, and I think everybody who graduated from J school when I was there at Columbia back in 78 had jobs, and we started mostly at newspapers but also local television stations. Nowadays, these jobs are not so guaranteed, or if you do get jobs, sometimes you get their non-paying internships when our students leave, or they go into beginning jobs at newspapers or local television stations, but their futures are not as bright, perhaps, because they know that the survivability of the publications that they work for are in question. So we are trying to change as a program, and we are encouraging our students to be as versatile as possible and to be entrepreneurs of their own careers, which means knowing web-savvy tools, skills, being versatile in a host of media, including digital television, radio, and print, so that they can be better situated for dealing with this future. But it is a daunting one, and our students come and sometimes put themselves into serious debt of $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, knowing that perhaps their careers are not guaranteed, but they come here with still that same zeal and idealism for what journalism means in a free society.
You talk about students' futures not being as certain. And there's one story that you tell in the book about a young woman who has just begun her career, and she's asked to do something that she considers to be unethical, something that she was taught in school would never be acceptable. But she's working in a climate where it just isn't – she's just not able to express that, and she's forced to sort of go along with something that she disagreed with.
Yeah. The anecdote has to do with a student who came and got her degree at our program and then started work at a local television station in California. And this was during the era of the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky scandal. And I remember at that time, feeling so out of touch with reality because I was teaching a large undergraduate lecture at the time, and I was using the Clinton scandal as a kind of wedge to explain all kinds of things about the role of, the executive branch, legislative branch, what a special prosecutor does, all kinds of things, affidavits, subpoenas, everything, explaining to students from the news what was happening in as far as education. The student I invited back because she'd gotten been successful in local television, and she happened to be in the Bay Area, and I invited her to the lecture, and she talked a bit about the story she did, and she inspired the students and showed some clips of her work, everything from, you know, covering the weather to covering crime to extensive interviews with school board officials, et cetera. And it wasn't until after the lecture that she said that we were talking about her career, and she said that she was very concerned because she had been asked to do something that she felt was unethical by her station, which was to try to lend some more sensationalism to the Clinton-Monica Lewinsky scandal by going out into her community and trying to find a married man who was having an affair in order to write about, in order to report about, you know, the effect of sexual affairs on a marriage. And this was somebody who had been trained in thousands and thousands of dollars in responsible journalism, being asked by her employer to do something that she didn't feel was worthy of the station. But, you know, she couldn't, she had to do the story. She, you know, she couldn't quit. She couldn't protest. She couldn't exactly walk out because her career would be somewhat in danger. And so because she had been skilled in good journalism, she went out and happened to find, after a couple of days, someone who was willing to be reported on camera for this piece. Now, this was local television, and we know the sort of values that go into local television increasingly. These are some of the issues that students deal with, but it's only gotten worse, as far as I can see, since 1996 when the scandal was happening. I mean, now we see, for instance, there's a local television station in San Francisco that, without telling viewers, turned over an entire week's worth of 6 p.m. newscasts to stories about Australia, which seemed ostensibly journalistic in nature, but it wasn't revealed until a week later that these works were compiled by the government of Australia to encourage tourism. This was an entire week's worth of local television turned over surreptitiously to the government of Australia. And these are kinds of the incursions that go on in television and in print as well.
Yeah, can you talk for a minute about how much PR we are reading and seeing and hearing in all mainstream media these days?
Well, it's certainly been a problem all the time. I mean, there is this natural clash between journalism and PR. You know, the aim of journalism is sort of report the truth without fear of favor, you know, for the interest of the public so that we can be informed in order to make, you know, the right decisions in a democratic society. And the role of PR is something a little bit different. The role of PR is to spin, to propagandize, to encourage people to do one thing or another, whether it's to vote or to buy something.
We should point out that not all PR is unethical, but
okay, no. I'm not saying it's unethical. It's certainly, and in fact, I think the codes of ethics of public relations are followed, adhered on a wider scale than journalism ethics these days. No, I think it's a worthy endeavor. The problem is there is a natural clash there, and there always has been. I think the problems are that PR, because of these filters of journalism, are sort of evaporating in the news industry. The motivations of public relations are holding greater sway in our society, and you can point to certainly industry as well as government. I mean, the Bush administration, just a couple of years ago, it was revealed that for some time they've been doing fake news broadcasts in order to sell public opinion on things, including Medicare packages. I mean, these are video news releases made to look like journalism, but in fact are nothing but PR and propaganda, but very difficult for the really discerning, for the non-discerning citizen to see.
Neil Henry is my guest. He's an associate professor in the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. His new book is called American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in an Age of New Media. After the break, we'll talk about a lot more topics, including newsroom diversity, bias, and why Americans don't trust much of what they see and read. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, language, history, and travel start in September. Learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Neil Henry. He is an associate professor in the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. He is also a former correspondent for The Washington Post. His new book is called American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in an Age of New Media. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. Neil, for several decades now, a lot of conferences of professional journalists have talked about the importance of having diversity within the newsroom for a variety of reasons. Has this been an effective movement?
That's a good question. Also, just to correct you about something, and the book came out about I worked on it for 3 years, and it came out in May. And since it was published, I'm now a professor, and I'm actually serving as interim dean at this school.
Well, so, congratulations. That's excellent
news. I think commiserations are it's a tough job to try to stay on top of things at a school of journalism. It's an excellent question that is somewhat complex, but I'll try to make it somewhat understandable. I'm an African American, and I grew up in Seattle. There are different ways people become inspired to go into in a particular profession. I grew up in the age of segregation, and because of segregation, there were certain doors that were closed to one, certainly in schooling and in jobs in the workplace. But I was a beneficiary of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and by the time I entered college and then was looking for something to do as a career, I saw journalism as a way, not just because of the inspiring things I talked about before, but also because a real decision had been made back in the late 1960s that in order to improve coverage of American society, newsrooms, news leaders needed to diversify their staffs in order to report the full gamut of views and backgrounds of people who contributed to the news. That body that was most instrumental was called the Kerner Commission in 1968, which was looking at some of the root causes of the riots that broke out in many cities across the country back then, including Detroit, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C. The newspapers and the news industry really decided they were going to try to do something. In Los Angeles, the Times, in 1965, when the Watts riots broke out, they looked around the newsroom and realized they didn't have a single African-American on staff, didn't even know hardly where Watts was. In order to report it, they went down to the press room and found a man, an African-American who was working as a printer, to go to Watts to report by telephone to the newsroom about what was happening. And to make a long story short, the fellow's name was Bob Richardson, and that year the Times, because of that fellow's reporting on a telephone from Watts, the Times won the Pulitzer Prize. And that was an example of how you needed people of different backgrounds, different skills, different knowledge, could improve news gathering. So in 1967, riots broke out in Washington, D.C. In 68, after Martin Luther King was killed. The Post, Washington Post, also didn't have many African-American reporters. And I was kind of a beneficiary of such policies. I became an intern at the Post was part of an era there that saw an incredible diverse array of people joining the news staff. I am a firm believer that newspapering and journalism can only be enhanced by people of various backgrounds. I mean, it just stands to reason that if you have people who speak Spanish, people who speak Chinese, people who are poor in backgrounds who come into journalism, that kind kind of depth of understanding improves the product of journalism. There have been standards that have been aimed at in trying to reach diversity, according to the American Society of Newspaper Editors and other organizations. Those standards have yet to be met, but I think there were tremendous gains that were made since between, say, the late 1960s and the 1990s. But it's also true as the industry goes into full retrenchment and as newspapers go into free fall, diversity in hiring is certainly not high on their priority list.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Professor Neil Henry. He is also interim dean at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. His book is American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in an Age of New Media. Let's talk first to Jerry in Sherman. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, one of the things I wanted to mention is one of the reasons that Americans don't have much credibility or belief in the media, and this goes back before the age of new media. I've got a specific example from the election of 92 with Ross Perot's campaign. I happened to be watching C-SPAN at work that day, and I saw a raw feed of an interview with Ross Perot where he was announcing his candidacy. And they asked him if he thought he was going to spoil the election by coming out as a third-party candidate, and then he gave a fairly eloquent response about the American tradition, American people, and how we have the capability of doing everything we want to do, and he talked about the capability of the American people. And he said, we can do anything we want. And he's speaking about the people in general. Well, the Associated Press, the next day, in their report about that interview, said that they asked him if he thought he was going to spoil the election by coming as a third-party candidate, and his response was, we can do anything we want to. So the way the AP, a mainstream organization, reported that story completely slanted the information and slandered Ross Perot, and that kind of treatment went on throughout the campaign with coverages on Newsweek, the way he was portrayed on the mainstream magazines. It was always slanted to diminish his candidacy and basically ridicule. And that's just one example of what happens in not new media, but mainstream press. And the more people have access to actual raw data like C-SPAN, the more that becomes apparent. And so that's one of the reasons I think people just don't trust the main news organizations anymore.
Jerry, thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome.
You know, what's interesting about that, Neil, is the idea that someone like Jerry actually went to the trouble of watching the entire feed. But so many people either can't or simply choose not to look for more information.
Right. The caller raised very valid points, I think have been valid for the mainstream media throughout. There are quality publications, and I think the AP is the gold standard of wire services, certainly in America. And I don't mean to certainly excuse that reporting, but there are certain restraints on the ability to be as in-depth as perhaps the public would like. The AP, you know, you work on deadlines and you have space limitations, and how do you get the full story in a short amount of space in a short amount of time? That's not to excuse it. It's just to try to explain the sort of pressures of what journalism is. And he's absolutely right, and his view is certainly reflected by a majority of the American citizens who are incredibly alienated by the traditional press for many reasons, and a lot of it has to do with scandal, whether it's fabrication or slanted reporting or issues like the Bush National Guard's records story by CBS, which was outed as a fraud by new media. The thing that troubles me most isn't necessarily that kind of alienation, because increasingly as the public tries to find alternate sources of information, they can find things, raw information on the web. The thing that most troubles me is the alienation of young people from this entire realm of what we are as a culture and a society. A recent report by the Shorenstein Center at Harvard pointed out that not only do young people between the ages of 18 and 35 not look at a newspaper either in print or on the web. That's 16%. Only 16% actually look at a newspaper on daily or on the web. But most young people don't even see news as an integral, central part of their lives. It used to be in American society that it was part of our family life. We'd look at newspapers. We'd share sections of the newspaper. I'm speaking about in general. And at night, we'd have the 6 o'clock news where the family would gather either dinner or after dinner, and it would be the news would be a part of what we were. But with the explosion of cable news outlets, 24-hour news, the explosion of information sites on the web and on the internet, it's become a kind of solitary affair. The news, that is, you have to sort of search it, and as you search it out, if you do search it, you go to preconceived places that you feel were, in general, sort of only reinforce what you already believe. And it's not really a part of our home life anymore. It's not a part of our culture as a society. And young people, in fact, don't go to the web for news. It comes their sort of seventh or eighth or ninth thing that they do, and they may have run across a link on Yahoo and say, but it's not really a part of what we are as a society.
You know, bringing up that idea that younger people are not consuming news on a regular basis, of course, raises the question of things like The Daily Show, which is alternately, criticized heavily and praised. On the one hand, it really is sort of a tool for media criticism. A lot of the way that show is used is to point out, the strange way that things get reported. But it seems as if it's although it's supposed to be an enhancement to actually watching the news, people are using this as their only source of information.
Yeah, and I think it's great. I thank goodness for things like The Daily Show that use satire, humor, wit to both skewer the news, but also inform. A lot of my students and undergraduates will tell you that the news that they get on television comes from The Daily Show.
Are they going back and looking at what the real story was after they've seen it on The Daily Show? Or is that
it? I tell them to, but I'm not sure they do. Yeah. I have a 14-year-old daughter, and she is the daughter of a journalist. I have hard copy stuff all over my house, books and newspapers and magazines. But she is very much a product of her age. She's she's bright. She does active things. She's social networking. She does the text messaging on cell phones, and she does the social networking sites like Facebook and MySpace and all those things on the web. But she has no interest in looking at a newspaper or even following the news unless it's a Yahoo link. And I look at this and I'm troubled. I have great hope for my daughter, and I know she's going to be wonderful in whatever it is that she wants to do with her life. But as the child of someone who is so immersed in sort of what the news is, like I am, if that's the case for a young person, you replicate it across the country, young people just are not, they are not engaged with the news in the way that previous generations have been. And I don't know what this means for us as a society yet. And I'm troubled on the one hand, but I'm also excited by all the wonderful things that young people are into. And I just don't have the answer yet. All I know is I have a certain belief in like age-old things, like we live in a free society, we live in a democracy, and the way democracy works is you have an informed citizenry. What does it mean when the citizenry is informed, not necessarily by truth, but by, artifice or other things, or is not informed? I know that bad things have happened, bad decisions have been made because of these reasons. And so those are the kinds of things I think about when I think about the young and their disengagement from the news.
Neil Henry is my guest. His book is called American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in an Age of New Media. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk to Bert in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. Say, as a progressive NPR junkie here, I find plenty of opportunity to have a political debate with conservatives and friends and acquaintances. And what I find is you can barely have a discussion on the facts because they come at you from the, you know, they'll listen to Rush Limbaugh all day and go to conservative blogs and watch Lou Dobbs at night. And, you know, if you cite the New York Times or something, you know, they'll immediately scoff as if your source is tainted and it's not fair and balanced. And yet they go to nothing but partisan, opinionated sites to get their facts. It's like a huge segment of the population is self-selecting a message, you know, that they want to hear, and then they internalize that, and they think that's objective. And I find that you can't even have a discussion anymore. And I mean, I know you're going to be inclined to disassociate, you know, liberals versus conservative, but I mean, that's just been my experience. But you could look at it from a broader point of view. It seems like with all of the choices out there now, people are going to those sites that tell them a point of view that they gravitate to naturally and feel good about. And it's harder to get an objective truth, you know? Do you understand what I'm talking about? You feel like that's kind of happening?
Absolutely. I think you've hit the a real key button that's sort of a symbolic of the age. We are, because of ostensibly the increasing numbers of outlets that are available to us, we tend to gravitate to those things that only tend to reinforce what we already know. That doesn't improve our intellectual capacity, not just for learning new things, but also our ability and willingness to engage in productive discussion. As far as I can see, I mean, I use words like segmentation and disassociation and words like that, disconnection, in my book to explain this kind of process. And you know, the problem is that because you have a kind of religious faith and a particular point of view, if you are not open to what actually the truth is, all manner of bad things are possible. I mean, the study by the University of Maryland a couple of years ago pointed out that a majority of viewers of Fox News still maintained the belief to this day, by the way, that Al-Qaeda was aligned with Iraq and behind the 9/11 disaster, and that this was the reason that we went to war in Iraq. Now, this is a fallacy. It's not true, but it's been hammered home over and over by the talking heads on Fox News to a point where majority of the viewers of Fox News believe it. And I should say parenthetically that a majority of viewers and listeners of NPR knew the opposite was true.
Neil Henry is my guest. He is interim dean and a professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. His book is called American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in an Age of New Media. You can join us after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372. If you find the lines full, send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, language, history, and travel start in September. Learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor Neil Henry. He's interim dean at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. His book is called American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in an Age of New Media. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk next to Gordon in Dallas. Hi, Gordon.
Hey, good show, you guys.
Thank you.
Interesting. You know, I've been talking to some of my friends about why people don't read newspapers anymore. I mean, I read the New York Times every day. I find it to be really relaxing. You know, I enjoy getting in-depth news and everything, but a lot of my friends just don't seem to appreciate it as much. And when I ask them, they say, well, the media is too corporate. And when you say something like that, it could mean any number of things. So when I press them and, you know, we try to get a little bit more specific, you know, too corporate often boils down to the fact that a lot of newspapers are not speaking truth to power as much as they should be. And one of the reasons they're not doing that is because they're beholden to their advertisers. You know, money is so hard to find, and the advertisers use the money that they're willing to spend on advertising to hold the newsrooms hostage. And consequently, the newsrooms are afraid to be really courageous the way that they used to be back at the turn of the 20th century. And so what that boils down to is when you say the media is too corporate, it's that the corporations are not fulfilling their public duty by allowing the newsrooms to be independent and to actually speak truth to power. I mean, I was corresponding with a friend of mine in New York the other day, and we were talking about that, and he said that newspapers don't speak truth to power anymore. They actually speak power to the powerless.
And, Gordon, thank you so much for calling. I want to have time to make sure that, that we get a response for you.
Okay,
thank you very
thank
much.
You.
How does that happen, Neil, in a world where, by every standard of journalism, technically that's supposed to be completely off limits? You're not supposed to have the advertisers speaking to the editorial folks at all.
Yeah, there's an ideal in the industry where there's a firewall between business and journalism. A firewall meaning that the two shall not be, you know, interspersed, because the aims of business, making money, being profitable, getting advertisers, should be different from the aim of journalism, which should be to report the news and information and the truth independent of other variables. But of course, we know that reality is different from the ideal. There are all kinds of situations where business interests certainly play a role in editorial decisions. And I think that was the big factor, the big bone of contention between the recent in the recent story of Rupert Murdoch's takeover of the Wall Street Journal. Here is a man who is when you talk about corporate journalism, he's corporate with a capital C and a capital J. He's a media titan who is renowned for his conservative views and also his deep business interests, and everyone is deeply concerned about what impact his motivations, his business motivations as well as political motivations will have on the gold standard of American journalism, that is the Wall Street Journal. And so they hammered out some sort of agreement where there is an independent board that's set up to sort of make sure that Murdoch is not going to have any impact on these decisions. Well, I think it's somewhat naive to think that that publishers don't have impact, because they do. There's an old saying by, I think it was H.L. Mencken, who said that the press is free to he who owns one. And in this case, in the Murdoch case, we'll have to see. But the larger point that the caller presented is very true and very concerning to me, that speaking truth to power has become rare in our media today. We know, you know the scandal in Iraq with the Abu Ghraib prison story, where American servicemen were torturing detainees. This was a story that was worked on by Seymour Hersh of the New Yorker magazine for some time. He was also the man who revealed the horrors of the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War, where the American military wanted to cover it up and call it a great victory by over the Viet Cong. He told the story, but it didn't come out until a year later. He, you know, Seymour Hersh spoke truth to power. CBS News had also this Abu Ghraib scandal story and told the Pentagon and White House about it. But they sat on it for weeks at the behest of the military and the White House, saying it would hurt national security. It was only because Seymour Hersh, again, spoke truth to power and CBS heard about it that CBS went forward with the story. And I think that alienation that the caller talked about is very true, and I think that corporatism is a part of it. But by the same token, you can't sort of dismiss all corporate media. I think, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post is certainly corporate media, but they are still working at the top of their game.
Most journalists, Neil, are not earning as much as other professionals who've achieved sort of similar levels of career success. Is it surprising to you, public broadcasting notwithstanding, that there's not a greater swell of journalists pursuing sort of a nonprofit avenue to do their work?
Well, I kind of think that that's perhaps might be the model for the future, because I think the profitability, the sort of private model just isn't cutting it anymore. And the factors are many. You can't get the revenues. Circulations are declining, for instance, in newspapers, obviously. You can't get the print revenues from advertising because advertising is flocking to sites like Craigslist because it's free and more effective, apparently. And as this downsizing happens, you have the ability of newspapers and local television stations not to be able to pay anymore. And on the web models of newspapers, they are not being profitable because they can't attract the kind of revenues to support advertising on the web that you can in print. And so what this leaves is, I think, a growing number of very thoughtful people believe that the public model, the nonprofit model, is the one that'll best serve the public interest. And that model is not just NPR and PBS, but they also point to organizations like the BBC in England as a kind of public or government, but it's certainly a nonprofit model. And the BBC produces just excellent reporting around the world. It's far as I'm concerned, the best. It was the Bible, certainly, I followed in my years overseas.
Neil Henry is my guest. His new book is called American Carnival. Let's go next to Matt in Dallas. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is really interesting to me. I feel like a lot of people, and I at least feel this way, is that like everything I get from the news is just someone else telling me what to think or telling me what's true. And especially with, you look at Fox News, which is so obviously, sort of marketed to a certain demographic. And then I kind of feel like some of the other news sources are maybe to the other extreme. And I'm just wondering, where can we go for something that's truly objective? And do you think it exists, or is it all editorialized, or where can we find the truth, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. You ask a terrific question. I think the first thing we can dismiss is the whole idea of objectivity. It never really existed, and certainly is not true today. Objectivity is certainly a myth because there's subjectivity in the process of journalism from the beginning. There's subjectivity about the stories that we choose to cover, subjectivity in the kind of sources we use to go to for news and information, subjectivity about where you put the story at the beginning of a newscast, the end, or at the top of a, above the fold in a newspaper or somewhere buried inside. So subjectivity is certainly integral, a part of all of this. I think objectivity is the wrong word and always been the wrong word, but the idea of balance, I think, is a stronger and more valuable term to use. And balance means trying to noodle an issue or a news story from as many different angles as possible to take into consideration and respect the different views that people have. And you present this truth as you know it with as many different viewpoints as you can. But nowadays, I think that model of balance and fairness has been overcome by so many other motivations. And these motivations include, the desire for greater ratings, desire for circulations. And you go back to Fox News. Fox News' popularity is built not on journalism, not on the product, not on its ability to gather and report the news fairly and without subjectivity. Fox's news popularity is built on bombast. It's built on cant. It's built on appealing to bigotry. It's built on many different things that are ratings grabbers, but it is certainly not built on what we traditionally view as fair and balanced public service journalism. And because of this, the journalism as a sort of motive for what news organizations do is not really, for a lot of them, is not the first thing that they think of.
I want to go back to your definition of balance. I think it's interesting because so many of the stories that we see and hear and read, balance means two sources. And you made a point of saying multiple viewpoints, because otherwise you run the risk certainly of elevating a perspective that is not only less valid, but certainly less common. And really, you know, you can have two sides of something that are polar opposites, one of which is a lot closer to the truth than the other.
Well, I wish I had an example off the top of my mind, and perhaps if I had more time, I could think of one. But yeah, that's exactly right. The truth is often not in those polar areas of, MoveOn.org versus Fox News. The truth is often in the gray areas, and they're difficult. I mean, they're the gray areas in between, and those are the richest and most valuable that I think we as journalists search for. It's so easy to appeal to those polls, but it's much harder to it's a hard intellectual endeavor to try to find the truth on any given subject. And you know, the fewer resources we pour into the craft of reporting and finding the news, then that idea of really having the truth to talk about is in shorter supply, I think.
Let's talk next to Mike in Arlington. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I wanted to mention that I have the sense that more and more of the journalists out there are less informed and less prepared, that they've spent a lot less time really understanding an issue before they begin reporting on it. And thus they're uneasy about challenging assertions and assumptions that people make when they're throwing out so much spin. And so they end up becoming less of a journalist and more stenographers. And I, you know, a lot of the journalists that I see out there are simply, you know, asking people, what do you say on this? And that's it. You know, they're letting them completely spin the story with no challenge whatsoever. And so I think it's so important, particularly in the education of journalists, to really press them to become fully informed on the subject they're reporting on and to be very willing to challenge every assertion that's being made so as to make news more interesting and less spin.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that's certainly, I hope we focus on at this School of Journalism is doing that kind of teaching, that kind of process of challenging the words you hear, asking the right questions, and making sure you try to get meaningful answers. But the fact is, I mean, we look at some of the examples of what we would think are the leading news organizations in the country, and we think about the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003 and how close a lot of these media centers were to the halls of power, so that they were subject to spin by various sides, you know, questioning or not questioning the weapons of mass destruction issue in Iraq. And it turned out that the people who really did the best questioning were not those who sought the closest ties to the halls of power, to be close to them, but the ones who really produced the best reporting were people who journalists who represented the small towns in America, happened to be in Washington, were representing the small towns in America, middle America, and the South, where many of the young people who were going to be bearing the brunt of the fighting were living. And they were the ones who kept hammering home the question of, you know, what is the rationale for going to war? And that kind of reporting, you know, bearing in mind that you're reporting for people back home, people whose these decisions really affect, is something that the best of journalism is always in touch with. But if you are too close to power, then you lose that sense of mission.
Professor Neil Henry is a former Washington Post correspondent and the interim dean in the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. His new book is called American Carnival: Journalism Under Siege in the Age of New Media. Neil, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro, with production assistance from Maggie Conklin. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.